You've just tuned into Outdoor News Radio, a weekly showcase of the top outdoors writers and experts in Minnesota and across the region. I'm Outdoor News Managing Editor Rob Dreeslein, and I'm honored to have you join us for the next hour as we break down hunting, fishing, and natural resources topics affecting your ability to recreate in the Western Great Lakes and beyond. Our guests might challenge you occasionally, but we promise to entertain you while we're at it. Don't go away, because if you love this state's fine outdoor scene, you'll love Outdoor News Radio. This segment is sponsored by Ducks Unlimited. Join the thousands of volunteers having fun more than 3,500 times a year. Get involved at www.volunteerfordu.org.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another week of Outdoor News Radio. I'm Rob Dreeslein. Thanks a lot for tuning in. Man, oh man, fall is progressing quickly. The pheasant opener is already in the rearview mirror. We've got our antlerless deer seasons and our youth deer hunt this weekend, and just a few weeks out till the general firearms deer opener. So a lot of opportunities for everybody. Small game leaves are starting to come down. That's improving the grouse hunting out there. We got a lot to talk about here today. We'll have Les Meister a little bit later. We're going to talk with him. I know for sure about the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame inductees. He's on that committee, so we'll talk to him about that a little bit. I want to talk about this BirdCast website that the Cornell Lab of Ornithology operates, and we're going to have a guest on to talk about that, where you can see how many birds migrated through your county the night before. Kind of a non-game topic. But let's kick it off with some DNR chatter and some regular game topics with Tim Spielman, editor of Outdoor News, who got out last weekend and tried to chase some pheasants. Tim, you wrote your column about it. Sounds like you had a good time. Maybe didn't see a lot of birds. Still a lot of standing corn, huh?
The thing was, we saw a lot of birds. Not so much a matter of not seeing birds. It was not seeing birds where they were supposed to be, which is not unusual, but it's a little, you know, it's frustrating. But the beauty is that I'm not a one-and-done pheasant hunter, so right. I always think positive. And I think, you know, when I get back to that area come the first part of November, I'm going to clean house. So,
because you saw a lot of birds, just not like say where they were supposed to be, not within shooting range.
Yeah, and I think Tori mentioned in a story too, and I think we saw a lot of it. But there were birds that got up that I saw from down the line a ways, and I gave them a yell that it was a rooster, maybe a little bit too late. But these birds, when they were getting up in front of people and heading the opposite direction, they couldn't tell if they were roosters or not. And I think there are probably a lot of younger birds out there yet, and it's just really hard to tell right away. So there were some shots that could have been taken that weren't because you don't want to make a mistake, obviously.
Good. Well, we got the South Dakota opener this weekend. Crop harvest out there probably on par, maybe even a little ahead of where it was in Minnesota. So should be some great hunting out there. And yeah, I'm sure you'll keep us posted, Tim, on how your season goes the rest of the way. You mentioned in your column, Tim, we had a letter to the editor, someone chiming in with his thoughts about how we could tune up the waterfowl season. You said you agreed with it, partially because it sounded like you wish you could have hunted some ducks, but you were kind of stuck in the middle of that season split, huh?
Yeah. The long and short is that the letter writer suggested, and I understand people who hunt Mississippi area, they like that late season. Why wouldn't you? It sounds awesome. And some people that field hunt. But where I'm at in the Southwest, the letter writer suggested somehow, if it's possible, and those federal frameworks are tough to figure out, but it seems like years ago, Wisconsin had a season that was, they carved it out so people that were hunting those river and backwaters areas could have their hunt. But other areas, even though they were in the same southern part of the state, were in a different zone. And this letter writer made sense because it's easy to say because you never know what's going to happen in November as far as freeze up. But
oh, absolutely. Even late October some years.
yeah. But in that entire South Zone, there was about almost a 2-week closure. And the Central Zone opened last weekend on the 11th, same day as the pheasant opener. And the Southern Zone doesn't open until the Saturday today. So It seems like a pretty long split for at least that part of the state. And there were a lot of ducks around. I mean, the duck opener was not great. It was warm. Right. Yeah, we talked about that. And there were a lot of ducks around. I kept looking down at the, you know, we kind of hunt pheasants around a little slough. And you look down there and you see all these ducks and there's geese flying over and you think, dang, that'd be a nice option if it were an option. So I don't know. It's worth considering. I didn't have a chance to talk to anyone from the DNR about if that even was possible, but I don't know why it wouldn't be. Just my 2 cents.
No, that's good stuff. I'd encourage folks to read Tim's column in this week's Outdoor News to get his take and more specificity. Outdoor News Radio here, Rob Dreeson and Tim Spielman kicking off the show. Tim, for the remainder of the segment, we should talk about this Office of Legislative Auditor report that came down on what forestry practices on state wildlife management areas. We've been talking about this for
6 almost.
Okay, all right. And we've been awaiting this OLA report. I've given you my opinion a time or two on the Office of Legislative Auditor. I guess it's important. I like watchdogs. It seems like we've covered a lot of these reports over the years. They don't have a lot of teeth. Their recommendations.
Right.
I think DNR says they're going to follow through on it, right? But it's not like there's any enforcement authority to make them do that. Why don't you bring us up to speed, I guess, on the issue again quickly and what this report said.
Yep. So basically, like I said, it was almost 6 years ago. The state set a standard for how much timber to harvest on state lands, which includes WMAs. Once things were being implemented, there were a number of 28 field employees from the DNR who raised concerns about the fact that they didn't like the level of timber harvest on wildlife management areas and the fact that those timber harvests didn't appear to be in the best interest of wildlife. And all sorts of things happened. Groups got involved. Legislators got involved. Eventually, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service got involved because those lands were purchased in part with federal dollars. And eventually, that led to the Fish and Wildlife Service, when they didn't like what they were seeing, suspended funding, which eventually, once everything was ironed out with DNR received those funds. But still, in the meantime, actually, this began in 2024, so it's a little over a year old, that these concerns were brought to the Office of Legislative Auditor, and it took a little while, but we got a report. So to me, it seems like a large part of this could have been avoided had communication been better. That may be too simple, but as far as the DNR and Fish and Wildlife Service, they seem to have gotten on the same page. So it was a lot of drama, years worth, that seems like, to me, it didn't really have to go that way. But on the other hand, with this legislative review, OLA review, there's a lot of data in there, and it's nice sometimes to have all that within a report. There are recommendations, like you said, but the DNR doesn't have to follow them. But on the other hand, as I watched the presentation today, there's the Legislative Audit Commission, which is comprised of legislators who would take a special interest in this. So if there is something that needs to be done, if the DNR needs to be told that they must do something, there are legislators who are there that can bring it up in the next session. So it's not entirely toothless, to put it that way.
Okay. Well, that's a good way to look at it. I'd encourage folks to read the story in the print version or on the website. Eric Morgan, our web editor, will have a link. So if folks want to see the entire report, Tim has dissected it and summarized it. But if you really want to dive in, how many pages is it? You know, off the top of your head, Tim?
I think somewhere just south of 20, I believe.
Yeah, okay, well, that's not horrible.
Not that I notice layout, because that's not my forte anyway, but the OLA does a nice job with their reports. They're very reader-friendly, put it that way.
They have very competent people there. I don't mean to take cheap shots at them. I mean, they're very, very professional accountants, and I think they've got some good communications people that know how to write a report so people can actually understand it. So that's to their credit. Like I say, I just feel like I've read a lot of OLA reports over the years that a month later, no one ever thinks about again. But perhaps this one we will, you know. So
right.
All right. Well, Tim, thanks for breaking that down. A bit of a dry topic, but one that we had to spend some time on since it's been stewing, as you said, for more than half a decade.
Yeah. And I know what you're saying. I guess the bottom line with something like this is that you want your WMAs to be managed for wildlife because the people that listen to us are the ones who use them. They're the ones who hunt there, and wildlife is their interest. And that's what it's supposed to be per law, is focus on wildlife habitat.
Good. Thank you. Good summary there. At the end, Tim, bringing it back around. I appreciate that. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, thanks, Tim. Have a good week ahead, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. Sounds good.
Stick around. More Outdoor News Radio after these messages.
Whatever you're hunting, be it small game, predators, gobblers, or big game, Henry Repeating Arms has a rifle or shotgun you can trust. With over 200 models to choose from, every Henry is proudly made in Wisconsin, backed by a lifetime warranty and supported by top customer service. From the squirrel woods to deer camp, there's a Henry for your hunt. Order your free Henry catalog today at henryusa.com. You'll also get a sheet of decals, the Henry Repeater newsletter, and a personalized list of local dealers. That's henryusa.com. Get your free catalog today and gear up for the season.
Cold temperatures are on the way. If you're a hunter, you want to stay out longer, no matter what the thermometer says. Arctic Shield, L&M Fleet Supply, and Outdoor News are teaming up to give away the best cold weather hunting gear in the industry. Between now and the end of October, you can win a full set of Prodigy Vapor jacket and pants. We'll give away two full sets per week in October. To enter, just click on the contest tab at OutdoorNews.com.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand. Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high-density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kind of be ready, be Plano ready.
Attention hunters, have you bagged an impressive whitetail buck this season? Then show it off at the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal. The contest runs through January 2026. Bow, rifle, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome. Visit OutdoorNews.com for a shot at great prizes and bragging rights. Click the Best Buck Contest link atop the page at OutdoorNews.com to learn more, enter, and view official rules. That's OutdoorNews.com.
If you're deer hunting in Minnesota this season, be aware of chronic wasting disease. Sampling for CWD is mandatory in CWD zones during the opening weekend of firearms season, November 8th and 9th. Be aware that deer feeding and attractant bans are in place. Check online to see if your county is affected. Carcass movement restrictions are also in place. Dispose of your deer carcass locally and don't drive the disease. Learn more and check if your DPA has CWD requirements at mndnr.gov/deerhunt. That's mndnr.gov/deerhunt.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreisline with you for another segment. Thanks for tuning in. Check us out online at OutdoorNews.com, where you can subscribe to our print or digital versions, or give us a call at 800-535-5191. As I alluded to earlier, migration is underway. Of course, that's on the mind of a lot of waterfowlers here in Minnesota. But bird watchers are also, this is a big time of year for them as birds from Canada and other destinations circulate down through the Mississippi Flyway. Sam Tequila, in his column in Outdoor News a week or so ago, mentioned an interesting website, birdcast.org, where you can actually track the birds or an estimate of the birds that have moved through your county. It also provides some insight into what might be coming through your area. And I thought this is fascinating. I played around with the website a little bit, and I'm really flattered to have someone from the Cornell Lab of Ornithology who works on this birdcast.org website with us now. He's a migration ecologist and visiting scientist at the Cornell Lab. His name is Andrew Farnsworth, checking in with us from the Big Apple, New York City. Andrew, thanks so much for carving out some time to chat.
Thanks for having me, Rob. I'm happy to be here. This is great.
So you've been working on this BirdCast website for many years, like going back to the late 1990s. It's come a long way. We were talking a little bit off air. We'll get into the history a little bit, but let's talk about what it does. The public can access this, and there's some great, pretty simple pages here. One of the best is just like this migration dashboard. Again, go to birdcast.org and click migration tools. You can type in your county and tell me what I'm seeing here. I'm seeing 300 birds crossed Houston County, Minnesota last night. I typed that in because that's where my parents live and I do a lot of outdoor activities down there. It says the peak migration traffic was 4,400 birds in flight. Break this down for me a little bit, what I'm seeing on this page and the fact that anybody can type in their county and see similar data.
Yeah, thanks, Rob, for bringing that up. So the migration dashboard is pretty cool. And let me back up a tiny bit before I dive in. So BirdCast, what you're seeing in terms of these forward-facing pages that you can visit in when you look to the migration tools, it's all about using weather surveillance radar to track bird migration and to forecast bird migration too. So you may think weather surveillance radar is about weather, surely true. And the network of radars in the U.S. is definitely driven by the need to understand and study meteorology. But these radars are exceptional at detecting biological activity in the atmosphere, in particular birds. In fact, when there's biology like birds and insects and bats, birds tend to dominate it. So it's a really amazing tool, especially given that there's about a 30 or 35 year archive of these radar data that we can look backwards, we can look forwards, and really think about studying migration at the individual radar scale all the way up to the continental scale. So one of the things we can do with those radar data is that we've learned how to tell the meteorology, like rain and snow and such, from bird migration. And when we can filter out the meteorology, we can do some really cool stuff with those data. And some of that cool stuff is summarized in this migration dashboard, where you can see the number of birds migrating over your county at night. If you look at the site at night and visit there, it's about maybe 10 to 15 minutes old after the radars detect the data, we get the data and process it. So it's very close to real time. So if you're awake all night, you can watch the pattern of migration unfold in your county or your state. Not only can you tell what's happening as it's happening or just afterwards, say the morning after, but you can kind of look and go back in time a few years. We haven't loaded all of those 35 years of data in yet, but you can go back a few years and look at, oh, what happened on this day, you know, 2 years ago, or what happened in the spring in Houston County, or what does the migration look like? When do I expect the peak to occur, you know, in Minnesota, which, by the way, we've kind of just passed. By this time, usually in Minnesota, we figure it's sort of like half a billion birds have passed on average every fall. I said billion. That's right. Half a billion. So we're kind of post peak now, but there's still plenty of migration to come for sure.
I got to ask, who put that together that, wow, we can use this radar data to track birds? I got to think it was probably irritating the weather guys for years, huh?
Yeah. So
was it someone at the Cornell lab?
It was not somebody at the Cornell lab. Radar has an interesting story. I'll try to give it to you quickly. So radar was developed about 100 years ago, you know, sort of between World War I and World War II, during that very rich time sort of electrical engineering and physics and the evolution of all these new technologies and the realization like, oh, we can send out a pulse of microwave energy and see things, in quotes, see things in the atmosphere and track them. Of course, it was heavily used for military technology and tracking aircraft, but all of those early radar operators started to see patterns of things that were not rain and not aircraft that they dubbed angels. And of course, the birders that were among the radar operators, and there were many, realized like, oh, these are birds, you know, and there were, it's not that hard. It's not literally rocket science. So there was some very active effort, even pre-World War II, in understanding where birds were on radar and when they were being detected, obviously wanting to filter that out and understand what was an aircraft in particular at that point, kind of important to know that versus what's birds. But that, at the very beginning of the technological advance there, was this understanding that radar could detect birds. In the late 50s and early 60s, this wonderful, wonderful researcher who was one of my mentors, Dr. Sid Gautreaux, who is from Louisiana, great Cajun, was at Clemson for many years, really understood that, whoa, these weather surveillance radars are detecting birds, in particular in Louisiana, as they were migrating over the Gulf Coast in spring. And that was kind of the inception of like, wow, there's the potential to use this network of devices that are really detecting, you know, precipitation, but also are detecting all this other stuff in the atmosphere, including birds. That realization happened kind of like in the late 50s, early 60s.
You listen to Outdoor News Radio, Rob Gerisland. We are talking with Andrew Farnsworth, a migration ecologist and visiting scientist at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. We're talking about birdcast.org. Fabulous website if you want to know what's migrating through your area. And as Andrew mentioned a few minutes ago, we're just past the peak of migration, but there's lots to go here in Minnesota. Andrew, I want to point out this is free for the public to use, right?
That's right. Yeah. And the radar data are all publicly available. Taxpayer money funded this this network from NOAA and the National Weather Service. And those data are available and we can use them. And when we display them on Birdcast, you can check it out with no pay, no paywall, nothing. And then you can see an analysis of what's happened kind of at that continental scale as well. Really, really fun stuff.
Let's talk about this live bird migration map that I see here. There's you can click play on it and a line kind of grows across the country. What are we seeing here? I'm seeing purple areas. Are those areas where there's a lot of migration traffic?
Yeah. So when you visit the migration tools and you click on that live map at night, if you're looking at it, you'll actually see sort of nearly real time, maybe 10 to 15 minutes after the radar provides and detects the information, what's happening. And so it's kind of like a typical weather map, like a heat map. The brighter colors represent more migration. Mm-hmm. And there's a line that progresses across the map when you play that indicates when the sunset and then eventually the sunrise happens. And most bird migration happens at night. I mean, really an enormous, enormous amount of it. You're talking every year in the U.S., in the fall, between 4 and 5 billion birds are migrating at night over the country. So you can see this in this map. The map updates about every 10 minutes or so. You tend to see the pattern of sunset, that line moving across the country, and then birds come up into the atmosphere. They start flying for their nocturnal migrations, usually about 30 to 45 minutes after sunset. The brighter areas are more intense migration. The darker areas tend to be lower migration. And there's sometimes where there's weather involved where the radar is not detecting birds because the weather really dominates that when there's weather and birds together.
Looking at it, I'm seeing a lot of heat, you might call it, in the southern and eastern third of the country from the lower peninsula of Michigan down to Florida, including Texas. Is that to your point that we're kind of getting past peak migration? Is that what I'm seeing there?
You're seeing two things. So yes, part of it is you're seeing the distribution of migration happen in that part of the country because the pulse, if you will, the wave of peak migration is starting to get into that area, really sort of like, you know, between the Great Lakes and the southeastern U.S. at this point, many of the birds, that peak wave has just about passing out of the northeast and starting to move into the southeast. However, what also you're seeing here, which is really important, is kind of more proximate information. A lot of it has to do with local conditions at the time. Last night in particular, the weather was very favorable in this region from, say, the Great Lakes down to the southeast. And that's why we see migration there.
Yeah, I bet it's fun to kind of track that. I bet if you look at this every day, it starts to sync up in your mind what's going on with the weather and how that drives migration. Last question before we go, because we're almost out of time, Andrew. How is this helping birds? We read a lot about how songbird populations, non-game bird populations are struggling. They're declining, seems, over the long term. How is this this website helping researchers, scientists, help our bird populations?
That's a good question, Rob. I think there are three ways. Certainly, one of the biggest and important ways is that it's engaging people, right? People love numbers. People do love birds. And being able to understand and to really grasp, like, wow, this is the number of individuals that are moving, and this is where it's happening, and I can go out and experience it. Kind of the way to connect people to nature through those numbers and the patterns and that kind of thing. That's really critical in terms of engaging people and helping them understand. understand. Of course, a second component from the scientific perspective is, yeah, we're learning things about how to relate where and when birds are occurring with local weather conditions, with additional data about where habitat is, and being able to understand the dynamics of migration, sort of like science for the sake of science, that then also has incredible applications in terms of, if you want to do conservation, yes, populations of birds have declined dramatically in the last 50 years, in particular, migratory populations. So if we want to understand how we can take action, like, you know, making our glass windows visible to birds by treating them with decals on the outside, turning lights off at night, conserving habitat and creating habitat in particular areas, we can start to understand that from this very particular perspective of where large numbers of birds are when, and think in a much more dynamic way about how can we be proactive about conservation going forward, whether it's, you know, turning off your kitchen light at night, treating your windows on your skyscraper if you're a building owner, or on your house, planting native vegetation, you know, creating new wetlands, that kind of thing. All of this kind of has a nice arc to the story of what BirdCast does, from engagement to the science to then actually really dynamic and sort of targeted action to what can you do when to be most effective at saving birds.
Well, I want to encourage folks to check it out, birdcast.org. Great information. I got a feeling I'm going to get addicted to the site quite quickly, Andrew. Thanks for all you do. I can tell you like your job, and you've been working at it a long time. So thanks for joining us, and thanks for what you do to conserve birds out there, Andrew.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to chat, Rob. I really appreciate it. Please do go visit birdcast.org and check it out, and ask us questions if you have them.
Andrew Farnsworth from the Cornell Lab talking about birdcast.org. Please check the website out. It's addicting. It's really cool. Let's grab a break. More of the broadcast after these messages.
The journey to deer camp only comes once a year, and we know you've got plenty of heavy, bulky gear to pack. Introducing the new Diverge case from Plano. Lightweight where it counts, tough when it matters. Ultra durable and lightweight thanks to a tough shell exterior with high density foam that delivers molded protection without the bulk. And a drop zone lid tray provides a convenient workstation for keys, cartridges, and coffee during pre-hunt prep. The new Diverge series cases from Plano. Don't just kinda be ready, be Plano ready.
Cold temperatures are on the way. If you're a hunter, you want to stay out longer, no matter what the thermometer says. Arctic Shield, L&M Fleet Supply, and Outdoor News are teaming up to give away the best cold weather hunting gear in the industry. Between now and the end of October, you can win a full set of Prodigy Vapor jacket and pants. We'll give away two full sets per week in October. To enter, just click on the contest tab at OutdoorNews.com.
You fish the same waters year after year. But what if your next best fishing story is just a few miles away? Onyx Fish builds on 15 years of experience, giving hunters and adventurers a revolutionary angling tool to help you find new water, new access, and new fish. Find the right lake. Know the species, size, and abundance. Get expert local insight. Navigate to the right ramp fast. Then go fish in new lakes like they're your home waters. Don't chase reports. Make your own with Onyx Fish.
Is a trip to Alaska on your bucket list? It's time to dump that bucket and buy your ticket. And while you're there, fish the Kenai River with Jason's Guide Service. Jason is considered the best when it comes to catching Alaskan salmon, rainbow trout, and char. He's one of only a few guides that has the permit to fish in the Kenai National Wildlife Refuge, where the salmon are easy targets and the trout and char are plentiful. So cross that Alaskan fishing trip off your list and check out jasonsguideservice.com. That's jasonsguideservice.com.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole, intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Our outdoor heritage is at a crossroads. Fewer hunters and anglers mean less support for the wild places we love.
The Outdoor News Foundation is changing that story one young person at a time. For just $25, you can give a child a year of outdoor knowledge via scholarships, camps, and access to OutdoorNews.com. This Give to the Max Day helps us cast a legacy for tomorrow's hunters and anglers. Visit OutdoorNews.com/foundation to get involved and donate today. Welcome back, folks. Rob Gerisline here at Outdoor News Radio. Thanks for tuning in. If you like the content here, check us out online at OutdoorNews.com or call us at 800-535-5191. Outdoor News makes a great holiday gift. We have print and digital versions, so give us a call. We'd love to get you on board. I want to check in now with our old friend Tim Lesmeister. Tim is one of the top dogs at the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, the committee there that decides who is going to be inducted into the hall in Hayward, Wisconsin. And Tim joins us now to talk about the latest class of inductees. Tim, good to see you. How you doing?
Doing great. Yeah, and we do have a great batch of individuals going into the Hall of Fame in 2026. This year, it was incredible how many applications we had for induction. And as always, we have to weed through them because some are very legitimate. Some are just people that throw out an application. They're hoping that their uncle can get in because they caught a big fish. those there we all do sit around and chuckle a little bit about. But generally, the vast majority are people that are very experienced anglers in their fields. And many deserve, but few get in because you have to be the cream de la cream of the crop to get into the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame. We've got a really good bunch going in this year.
It's based up in Hayward, Wisconsin. They maintain record fish lists also. If you visit the hall, there's a building with like plaques, like the Hall of Fame. That, you know, all the different inductees have plaques. I've been to Cooperstown to see the Baseball Hall of Fame, so it's kind of similar to that one area there where you can see all the folks who've been inducted. And what, I don't know how many people have been inducted. Tim, is it hundreds? It's a lot.
It's a couple hundred, like 250 right in there. That seems like a lot, but it's been, you know, 30 years that we've been doing this. So when you break it down, it's not as many as you might think.
And every year the hall inducts, what do you think? 4 to 7 people?
Yeah, that's about right. 4 to 7 covers a lot of ground as well, because you know what, You talked about baseball. You've got pitchers, you've got catchers, you've got outfielders, you've got coaches, and each one of these individuals plays a different part in this industry. Same with fishing as well. You've got guides, you've got communicators, you've got, you know, manufacturers, and I'm talking about people that have literally invented fishing lures that have been stalwarts in your tackle box. I mean, we're talking about individuals that may have been involved with the biology of fishing and doing research. Covers a large group of individuals here that have had an impact on the sport.
Yeah, so it's not just famous tournament anglers or famous guides. You've got researchers in there. You've got biologists, even some fish managers have been inducted over the years. Again, I just point out a great website, freshwater-fishing.org, if folks want to check out the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame website while they're listening to Tim and I chat about it a little bit. All right, well, let's talk about the class this year, Tim. You got 7 people. Noteworthy, I think most years there's someone from Minnesota. There's actually not this year, is there?
But Wisconsin had a great showing this year, which is not unusual because when you look at guides, Wisconsin is truly the land of fishing guides. It seems to me that the muskellunge was a fish that many anglers over the years, going back to the early 1900s, wanted to catch a huge muskie. And there were people that could literally make a living just guiding through one season for the whole entire year. And they did. Some of these were resort owners. Some of them were just individuals and that made their entire living for years and years just guiding. It's incredible.
Northern Wisconsin and, you know, north central Minnesota also has a long, great guiding tradition too, Tim, of course. And there's a lot of guides from Minnesota that have been inducted into the hall over the years, I'm sure. But northern Wisconsin is so close to Chicago.
And yeah, it's true.
You know, I know that. My parents came from Chicago, although my dad actually spent more time in Minnesota as a kid fishing than he did in northern Wisconsin. But I know from being a kid and spending a fair amount of time in northern Wisconsin, there's Illinois license plates everywhere. In Indiana and even, you know, other points south, Ohio.
a lot of folks go to northern Wisconsin to go fishing, and a lot of them probably don't know a lot about fishing, maybe don't own a boat. And so there you go. That's where that guide culture kind of erupts.
Yeah. And this first individual that we put in was Jerry Costabile. You know, basically we say he's a Wisconsin guy because he's pretty well known in the Kenosha Racine fishing community as a Lake Michigan charter captain. He had 37 years experience there, but he also was incredible instructor. He used to do seminars, capacity crowds, and this guy was truly a great guide on Lake Michigan, and he's a 2026 Freshwater Fishing Hall of Famer. And then there's Lee Bailey Jr. from Florida, pro angler. Now, we talk about pro anglers. Not every pro angler that we put in there has won the Bassmaster Classic. Some of these individuals were very, very successful on other tournament trails. This guy did fish the Bassmasters, but he fished a lot of others as well. He was an individual that did teach. He had his own bass fishing challenge tour is what he called that. And he was definitely an individual that spent a lot of years guiding, a lot of years fishing competitively, and spent a lot of time teaching others to fish. Lee Bailey Jr.
Seems like that's a theme with a lot of these guys, Tim, is that they do a lot of seminars. They do a lot of educating the public in addition to their day job in the fishing world.
And that's what it takes. I mean, you can go out and win a tournament, and that doesn't position you for the Hall of Fame. You have to be, you know, well beyond that. Now, look at Daniel Eisterman. He is his contributions to fisheries management were incredible. This guy did a tremendous amount of work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. This guy was someone that just literally delved into a lot of different species in a lot of different regions and spent a lot of time figuring out what it takes to create great resources.
Tim, there's an example of a guy who the general public has probably never heard of, but has done a ton of work, you know, in the background, improving fishing for, you know, everybody.
Oh, in Tennessee, in South Dakota, in Wisconsin. I mean, you can just see the impact that he had on many, many areas here in the United States.
This is Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreesline and Tim Lesmeister talking about the 2026 class of inductees for the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward, Wisconsin. Check out their website, freshwater-fishing.org. Tim, who's next on your list?
Jason Shuckerett from Wisconsin. This guy is an angler who decided early on that he was going to be one of the greatest walleye fishermen in the world. It's hard to say that, you know, you'll ever attain that because there's so many great walleye fishermen. But this guy has worked his tail off to become one of the best tournament anglers out there. He's won on just about every major circuit there was. He's had 44 top 10 finishes. He's had many first place finishes. He's won championships. He was the host of the Next Bite television show, continues to host that show.
And a son who's done very well.
Yeah, he makes personal appearances all over at fishing events, and just a great walleye angler.
Then we got a Michigan guy?
Mark Sack. Mark Sack is, oh man, what a talented angler. Writer, television and radio host, president of the Michigan Outdoor Writers Association at one point. He's fishing seminars all over the country. He's just been active in the outdoor arena for over 30 years, writing, fishing, making guest appearances on all kinds of different radio and TV outlets. And if you haven't seen Mark Sack somewhere, you're just not paying attention.
And we're still not done with Wisconsin boys.
Bruce Shumway. He was a professional muskie guide. He was in the Hayward Cable area. There were a lot of those guys that made it into the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame, and I'm surprised it took this long to put Bruce in there. This guy, he had a hothead jig, which he called the Funky Chicken, and that was a lure that just about every muskie angler had in their box for a while. So these guys always do that. They'll be guiding, and they'll come up with lures, and they'll find some manufacturer that'll pick them up, and all of a sudden they're everywhere. And Bruce was one of those guys.
Yeah, muskie fishing and that Hayward area in northern Wisconsin, they just kind of go hand in hand. They love it over there.
Our last inductee is from Tennessee, and we all sit around at these meetings that we have, and a name will come past us that we go, I can't believe this person's not already in there. And that was this guy right here, Don Wirth. Don Wirth is one of the most read writers of the freshwater fishing scene of all time. His articles have appeared in virtually every issue of Bassmaster magazine since 1971. That's 54 years. This guy was an incredible writer, and he made it in this year. It's just mind-boggling to me that Don Wirth wasn't in the Hall of Fame a long, long time ago. But welcome, Don. You're a 2026 Freshwater Fishing Hall of Famer.
Well, congratulations to him and all of the others. I'd like to encourage folks listening here in Minnesota to get some nominations in for 2027 so that we can get some more Minnesota representation in the hall. There's a lot of folks represented there now. And of course, Minnesota also has its own Fishing Hall of Fame in Little Falls. But congratulations to them. Thanks for all you do, Tim, leading that committee and going through these nominations every year. And I'd encourage folks, check out freshwater-fishing.org if they want to learn more about these inductees and the Hall of Fame in general. Tim, thanks for joining me. We'll catch up a little later.
Sounds good.
All right, that was Tim Lesmeister. Appreciate him joining us. More of the broadcast after these messages.
Whether you're hunting private or public ground, Onyx Hunt gives you the edge. With detailed land ownership maps, you'll know exactly where you stand. Add in advanced weather, wind, and radar tools, and you've got the full picture to plan every hunt. Now, with Moultrie Mobile Trail Cam integration, you can even see photos from your cams right on the map for smarter scouting and better stand decisions. Download the Onyx Hunt app today and start your free 7-day trial.
Attention hunters, have you bagged an impressive whitetail buck this season? Then show it off at the Outdoor News Best Buck Contest, sponsored by Federal. The contest runs through January 2026. Bow, rifle, or muzzleloader, all hunters are welcome. Visit OutdoorNews.com for a shot at great prizes and bragging rights. Click the Best Buck Contest link atop the page at OutdoorNews.com to learn more, enter, and view official rules. That's OutdoorNews.com.
If you're hunting deer in Minnesota or surrounding states this season, be aware that deer carcass movement restrictions are in place in Minnesota. You cannot move whole intact carcasses out of CWD management zones or into Minnesota from other states, and only certain parts of your harvest can be transported. If you're heading to a licensed taxidermist from hunting out of state or in a CWD zone, there are regulations for you too. Visit mndnr.gov/deer imports to learn more. That's mndnr.gov/deer imports.
Love the great outdoors? Then you need Outdoor News in your life. Outdoor News is your go-to source for local hunting and fishing intel, conservation news, and outdoor adventure stories. Stay informed on seasons, limits, and the best spots to cast your line or set up your stand. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, Outdoor News has something for every outdoor adventurer. Subscribe today. Visit OutdoorNews.com or call 1-800-535-5191 to get started. Outdoor News, supporting the outdoor community since 1968.
We are the young minds that will shape tomorrow's world. But today, the world is in your hands. What's your vision for the future? Since 1937, Ducks Unlimited has been the world leader in wetlands and waterfowl conservation. And we've had the same vision for the future for more than 75 years. A future with clean water, abundant wildlife, plenty of places to enjoy nature, and wetlands, sufficient to fill the skies with waterfowl today, tomorrow, and forever. Sure, there's still a whole lot of work to be done, but we know we can turn things around together because we are the next generation of DU conservationists. And with a little help from you, our future is looking really bright. Ducks Unlimited, working for conservation for generations to come. Help carve a path for the next generation of DU conservationists at www.ducks.org/generations. A public service from Ducks Unlimited.
Hey everybody, welcome back. Outdoor News Radio. Rob Dreeslein with you here for our final segment. Tim Lesmeister going to help me bring it home. Check us both out online at OutdoorNews.com, where you can subscribe to the print or digital versions of our newspaper or our website, or call us at 800-535-5191. Outdoor News makes an awesome holiday gift if you're trying to think of something to get a loved one, an outdoors person, or anyone who just cares about conservation. Outdoor News is the way to go. Tim, a lot of headlines in this week's paper. I talked to Spielman about some of them earlier in the show, but I didn't get to a couple of them. We've talked a lot about the crossbow thing. And the legislature just allowed crossbows during the general archery season, carte blanche, here a couple of years ago. We're now into our third season with them. Last year, the legislature said, oh, hey, why don't the DNR do a report to see what kind of effect this is having on our deer populations? It seems like something they could have maybe thought about before they legalized it, but that's not how things work. So here we are. We got a report. And what do you make of some of the results from 30,000 feet?
Well, it doesn't look to me like it's had much of an impact on deer populations as some people thought it would. It's actually little effect, I think, on the deer numbers. And I think that's actually good. I think what we're seeing is that a lot of people that were hunting with the longbows have switched over to crossbows. And that was a number that I was really, really surprised when I saw that as women. 64% of women are now using crossbows. That was incredible. And I say that because I think that they just feel a lot more comfortable with a smaller bow. And that's what you get with a crossbow. With men, it's only 46% that transitioned in and are using crossbows now for their main bow. So you can see there's a huge separation between women and men. And I think it's great. I really do. I'm glad to see the proliferation of crossbows because I think you're seeing more people getting out there and hunting deer during the archery season. And I believe that really opens up a lot more opportunity, and I think it's just fantastic.
A couple points. Yeah, DNR, of course, is really pounding on the R3 aspects of this, that it's basically, you know, it's all about trying to get more people into the sports and keep the people that we have. I can see how crossbows are appealing to women. You know, for years we talked about vertical bows and women not being able to pull as much poundage as men, and what did that mean for killing shots? And the response always was, hey, it's about shot placement, not shooting at deer too far away. And that's all true. It's harder to put into practice. You know, it's harder to go out and kill a deer with 35 pounds of poundage on your bow compared to 55 or 60. And so crossbows neutralize that effect, right? They level the playing field. You can cock that crossbow, and now women can be shooting as much poundage as men in a crossbow. So I see how that's appealing. The antlerless aspect of this, well, first of all, Tim, we only got 2 years of data here. So I'm going to keep pounding on that fact. We're going to need more years of data. And the DNR makes that point repeatedly in the report. For folks who read the full report, they do make that point that we got 2 years of data. This is one small data point that affects deer and deer hunting in the state, right? I mean, we're coming off two incredibly mild winters. And so the deer population is looking pretty good going into 2025. So that's a much, much more important factor in deer populations than whether or not a solid chunk of archers were using crossbows. I do think, and the report talks about this too, the potential effect on antlerless deer and specifically in lottery areas could start to grow. And they saw that already. They're seeing some folks in lottery areas, you know, buying an archery tag because they can use a crossbow. And if you think about it, Tim, if you're a gun hunter in a deer permit area with lottery tags, you can only shoot a buck. Now I can buy a crossbow tag under an archery license and shoot either sex deer and have a very, very long season to hunt now, right? Because I can hunt the whole archery season. And I've got a pretty effective weapon out there, much easier to use than a vertical bow. And so I think that is going to result in some more pressure on our antlerless deer and could affect, you know, the number of antlerless tags in some of those lottery areas. Now, how many, we don't know. It's having a small effect so far. Will it level out? Will it get worse? Will it get to the point where the DNR's got to start limiting the number of antlerless tags during the firearm season in some of those lottery areas because so many people are using crossbows now? I think that's a ways out. I'll even say that's probably unlikely. But it's certainly possible. And if the trend we saw in year two here per this report continues, it could be an issue.
I think that what really affects deer populations more than anything is habitat and weather. And I think we've had a lot of great weather here lately, which has been good for the deer population. And fortunately, Minnesota has a lot of phenomenal habitat. That's why I don't think that your crossbows are going to have much effect. If they do have to make any modifications in certain permit areas, it's not going to be because crossbows are taking more antlerless deer. I think it's going to be because weather has knocked down the deer population.
Actually, you got me thinking, Tim, because this is kind of the best of times. It's not the very best of times for deer, but it's pretty good out there right now for deer in Minnesota after these two mild winters, which means there are a lot of lottery tags available, antlerless tags available in lottery permit areas. You know, what happens when we get two, three tough winters, if that ever happens again, and we really got to crank down on the number of antlerless tags allowed in some of those lottery areas, and then you got a bunch of crossbow folks out there taking a bunch of antlerless deer, I could see some grumbling in that scenario among some of the firearms hunting. But again, that's a ways out. We'll have to see. Outdoor News Radio, Rob Dreesine and Tim Lesmeister bringing it home. Tim, there was a good letter to the editor in this week's Outdoor News. Someone suggesting Minnesota should have a moose hunt again, a limited moose hunt for state hunters. We've got some tribal hunting going on. What'd you make of that?
I thought that this person had a very good point. Should we bring back moose hunts? I mean, if you look at elk here in this state, we don't have that many elk, and we have elk hunts. And if you look at states around us, they have far fewer moose than we have, and yet they're having hunts. I think there's only, 500 moose in North Dakota. They're having a moose hunt there. We've had a stable population now for a while. It may not be as high as it was in the past, but it's stable. And that means that we could potentially have some moose hunts here in Minnesota and probably not have an adverse effect on the population.
Yeah, I've generally supported the DNR when they canceled the moose hunt. It's 10 years ago? More than that, 15 years ago since they canceled moose hunting in the state. The population seemed like it was darn near in free fall. As I've talked about, I'm still ticked off about what happened to moose in northwestern Minnesota, and no one has a clue. To your point, it seems like the population has stabilized, and maybe the bigger issue for me is that there's several tribal bands here in the state that are killing moose. They go out and I don't know how many they're taking, 25, 30 moose, maybe a couple bands if we're up to 50, 60 moose being harvested by bands every year, and the state tolerates that. Why shouldn't the state go to the bands and say, hey, you know what, you guys can take 30, 40, we're going to take 10. And we're going to charge, you know, our hunters a fairly hefty fee for it. It's kind of a special tag, opportunity to go do that. And we're going to push that money into moose management. It seems like there's an opportunity here. And per the letter writer, yeah, there's other states that have fewer moose than we do, and they have hunts there.
Yes. So I think that right now we're in a great position to do that. If you remember when we were allowing moose hunting in Minnesota, it was a one-shot deal. You applied for a moose tag. And if you got it, you were done. If you got a moose, great. If you didn't, it didn't matter. You got your tag, and that was your tag for that year. And after that, you did not apply. It was over for you. I always thought that was a little weird. I think if you apply for a tag, you get one, and you don't get a moose, you might be let put back into the mix. But it was what it was, and I think they should fire it up again.
There's kind of an old rule in conservation, right? If you want to help a species, hunt it. You know, have people who care about it, who are invested in it, and want to see the population expand. And we're not talking about taking 100 moose or 200 moose. We're talking, maybe 5 or 10 tops, that many tags. And if they don't get one, they don't get one. But I think that letter writer makes a good point. Tim, before we go, we got a new wildlife management area up on the Rainy River, Pheasants Forever. Pushed hard on this one, even though there's no pheasants up there, but it's named after Bob Anderson, and of course, Bob Lessard, who is still with us. He was out there for the dedication. Bob's in his 90s, I believe. And Bob, crazy like a fox. I didn't agree with everything that he ever did as a legislator, but he certainly got a lot done and was pivotal in the sales tax dedication that helps fund things like new WMAs, like the one we got up on the Rainy River.
Yeah, that Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment that was passed in 2008 has generated a tremendous amount of money for the resources in the state. And Lessard Sams, when that passed, I think it was incredible that the sportsmen came out and said, we'll let you take money from us and use it. And I thought it was great. And they're naming this wildlife management area after these guys. They deserve it. 276 acres right on the Rainy River. I think it should be some phenomenal hunting up there. No question. There'll be a good grouse. Possibly if it's on the Rainy River, you might be able to get into some field hunting for ducks. So I'm really pleased to see that they just keep adding wildlife management areas to the state.
Tim, thank you for joining me. You have a good week ahead, my friend.
All right, we'll see you soon.
Tim Lesmeister. Thank you to him, all of our other guests. Everybody have a great week out of doors. I'm Rob Gerisline signing off for Outdoor News Radio. Missed a segment from this week's edition of Outdoor News Radio? You can hear a podcast of the complete program at OutdoorNews.com or via your favorite podcast streaming platforms. And for the rest of the story on the topics we cover here on the program, get yourself or a friend a subscription to Outdoor News. Just visit OutdoorNews.com. And don't forget to join us next week on this station to talk everything out of doors.